C1P. Number 5B.
So we come to the next subject, life. Here the tone of life is really, again, the fullness of life and maintaining the fullness of life, so that truth knowing maintains man continually in the fullness of life, so that there is no lack. Therefore, the practitioner here, considering what is the truth of being, will have to see that the divine method of treatment is to flood every case and every patient, so to say, with the fullness of life, that we never see any lack in a situation. Well, this naturally would ask us now, what does it mean to flood a situation with the fullness of life? Well, then I say, I know that life reflects mind and spirit and soul and principle, life, truth and love. Therefore, it floods every situation with the fullness of mind and the fullness of spirit and the fullness of soul and principle, life, truth and love. So, if we have some kind of a tangible, spiritually tangible consciousness of these tones, we can see, for instance, in mind, a fullness in mind, that with that flooding sense of life, we can increase now the mentality of the patient, namely increase his mental and moral power through mind, not through any mental despotism. You get here a great sense of the fatherhood of life, which says, how am I going to maintain a case? Shall I maintain it through hypnotism, through mental despotism, through dictating to the patient what he has to do? Or shall I do it through the great influence of mind, capital M, and therefore flood the whole situation with that one mind that is constantly at work? She reasoned it like this, and when we come here to life, it has a lot to do with life in contrast to heat and cold, quite a good subject for us here this week. She says, it is mortal mind that produces heat and cold in the body. That's my addition. That it is mortal mind that produces animal heat. And it's also mortal mind that says, I die. So she wants to bring out the life fact that isness never says, I die. Therefore, she says, change the mental state, and then the chills and fever, which is cold and hot, disappears. But don't change that state of mind through a false method, through unscientific mental practice, like using hypnotism, mental despotism, or malpractice, because we know with hypnotism we also can really influence a patient or anybody, so that when he is in a hot room, he is chilly, and if he is in an ice box, he is has fever or is hot. Hypnotist can do anything to a receptive mentality. So she has to show what is the right method to change that mental attitude. And so she says that the Christian Science demonstrates that divine mind does the healing, not hypnotism, not mesmerism, not mental practice, but the divine mind. And he does it through life by adding, can you hear, by adding, that's the fullness of life, by adding to the mental and moral power of the patient. By increasing, can you hear life? Increasing, it's the multiplication of life. By increasing his patient's spirituality. Okay, that's the tone that she presents. You can see, she has here the case that there is a belief of mortal mind that says, I can produce either heat or cold, and therefore we see it's mortal mind that produces it. Consequently, we can see that if we change mortal mind, that we can change that state of being hot or cold. But she says the wrong method would be to change mortal mind through hypnotism and mesmerism. But the right method of life is that you increase really the mental moral power of the patient through the divine mind. So I have you get the great sense, you know, of life as mind. You know, if you even know the synonymous terms well, we actually would feel that we could elaborate on Mrs. Eddy's text quite enormously, because when she has to bring out, say, a tone like life and mind, like all the other tones, she can only take one or two examples to illustrate it, because she can't write a whole book about every little subtone. But if we understand really life and mind as two synonymous terms, and you know that the synonymous terms always stand for the whole of God, and not just for a single idea of mind, or just a single experience or single example of mind, then if we know that, if we know the synonymous term, the picture becomes much vaster when we are giving a treatment on this along this line. So that, for instance, here, see, you have that great sense that you encounter quite often, that you say, well, here I have a patient, he is out of balance, he's sick and so on, and you have a feeling that if you could give him and flood his consciousness with constructive ideas, that then that would help the patient. And then something comes in and says, yes, that's all right, but his whole surrounding has a negative attitude, and therefore counteracts what you see in your treatment. Can you see? So that the whole flooding of good thoughts is of no avail, because the surrounding will counteract it and make it null and void. This belief you could easily handle through life as mind, with a capital M, not through life as good thoughts, as positive, constructive thoughts, but mind, because in mind, what do you feel? That there is only one mind, and therefore you would even go further and see that the whole surrounding of that patient, the whole universe, knows only what mind, divine mind, knows about that case. So that it is not only the practitioner that knows that the patient is under the one mind, but it also sees that the whole universe has only one mind, because there exists only one mind. Can you hear life as mind? What exists? Only one mind. There can't exist any other minds. And the mind of a patient that is receptive, and a lot of minds, many, that are not receptive and are counteracting. This can't exist. But you see that, really, only when you see the whole synonymous term of life and mind, so that you feel every situation is flooded. Life. Flooded by what? By just the fact that the whole universe has but one mind. And you don't split it up anymore in the mind of the patient and the mind of the surrounding and the mind of the universe and the mind of the doctor and the mind of the nurse and the mind of this and that and the other interfering with the case. Do you see that? Here, in this case, Mrs. Eddy just had to take up one example, and she did take up that one of cold and heat and so on, to show that mortal mind is actually producing this phenomena, and that we can correct it through the divine mind. But that mind naturally has many more applications, but just that. That's why as you go on, actually I shouldn't talk about this, this is a sideline, it doesn't really belong to this. See, but as you go on, and you really feel that you are mastering the tonality of the seven synonymous terms, your practice becomes very easy in the way, in so far that you don't really have to think about a lot of specific ideas and specific counterfeits and so on. You take that redundancy principle of the seven synonymous terms, and the seven synonymous terms include everything. Positively, they include all the ideas, and negatively, they cover all the beliefs, whatever the beliefs are. So, the clearer, the more distinct, the more defined the seven synonymous terms become in our consciousness, the more you will only be thinking in terms of synonymous terms and no more in terms of ideas and beliefs. See, then you touch really science, the science. Then we really are giving a treatment, you see, a treatment as God gives the treatment, if you want to say that, as God is conscious of a situation. See, when we go, especially here in this 12th chapter, if we go through the text, most of the text is written so that only a human mind can understand what you are talking. Only a human mind can understand something about mortal mind producing heat and cold, and mortal mind producing animal heat, and mortal mind saying, I die. It's only mortal mind that can take cognizance of it. If you ask the divine mind and say, do you know anything about this? The divine mind says, I don't know what you're talking about. I mind, know only mind, nothing else. I don't know what you mean with mortal mind. I don't know what you mean with producing heat and producing cold. I just don't know what you're talking about. You know, that's all Chinese, that's double Dutch, what you're talking here. That's not the language of spirit you're talking about here. Therefore, we begin to realize, you see, more and more, that as we understand the seven synonymous term, our flow in consciousness becomes very simple, not more complex. Very simple, always simpler, because we will use more and more that redundancy principle, which says instead of using all the various ideas of mind, you just use mind. Finished. If you know what mind means. And that's the point I would like to see that the student arrive at, that the textbook cultures us to come to this point, that the textbook gives us examples and illustrations and reasoning things out, until finally we arrive at the language of spirit. Now the language of spirit doesn't talk about mortal mind producing heat and cold, and about mortal mind saying I'm going to die and should I give the consent of it or not and so on. The synonymous term doesn't know anything about it. Yeah. That was a side remark, an important one, and a long one. We go back to our subject of life as mind, where we have seen that really when we sit down and are quiet within ourselves and contemplate the truth and know the truth, truth and mind, we see that this truth and mind is life. It's the only life there is, the floods of life. And that these floods of life maintain and sustain all that is right, all that is of the nature of ideas. So at the point of mind, really, we begin to see that life supports through the divine mind every idea. every idea in its fullness, so that he can never lose anything. We come to spirit. My epitome here is in spirit, that this divine method of flooding the patient's soul is instructing mortal mind that all strength, that spirit, the strength of spirit, and courage is in mind, not in matter. See, now she takes up the belief that matter says, I can have strength, but I can also lose that strength. Like in palsy, she takes up palsy and says, well, this is a belief that matter can paralyze the body, that the body can lose the strength, that muscles have no more power, that the muscles lose their strength. But she says, this is not true. The muscles have no strength to lose. We not even have to accept that the muscles usually have strength, and that we have to see that strength of the muscle is kept intact. She says, don't ever believe that matter has strength to lose, that body or muscles have power to be lost. Mind is supreme. And this cures palsy, she says. And the same, she says, it is with those who suffer under consumption. They too show a terrific courage, because their fear is so deep-seated that they have only one way out, to have blind courage. And so she says, don't fool yourself, they don't have courage, because consumption cannot produce a sense of courage. Their fortitude is actually fear. So take away the sense that matter, the body, muscles, or anything can have strength. The only strength there is the strength of spirit. Therefore, fill your patient's consciousness with that strength of spirit. How do you do that? By seeing that because the patient has been seen at before in the subject before, that is a metaphysical proposition and therefore is an idea of God or a principle, then we can see that the flood of life is constantly maintaining and flooding and sustaining and providing really the strength of spirit to every idea. That the idea has strength, and that the idea is conscious of that strength. And you get the terrific sense of life in and of spirit. So that the life is maintained and sustained by the strength of spirit and not by muscle. And by attributing and by giving to the consciousness of the patient this very fact, because he cannot have any other consciousness but the consciousness that God has, so we add to his strength the strength of spirit. Or we come to the point of soul. Again, we are asking, what is the divine method in flooding the patient's thought in soul? By filling life with good motives and acts. As against what? As against the self-deceiving, can you hear the counterfeit of soul? Against the hidden, can you hear the counterfeit of soul? Against the undefined, can you hear the counterfeit of soul? And insidious beliefs, can you hear the counterfeit of soul? See, we have to know the counterfeit of these seven synonymous terms so that we can recognize the tonality. See, soul is sinless, and soul is definite. And the counterfeit of it is malicious animal magnetism that works in the hidden, not definite, hiding away so that you can't see it, can't define it, can't detect it. It works, therefore, self-deceiving. It deceives without knowing that it is deceiving, instead of that definiteness of soul. soul that knows exactly and can define exactly. Against the undefined beliefs, soul is never undefined. But the moment we have that vague belief, that which you can't quite get hold of, you know, like the serpent, it just always slips you out of your hand. The insidious belief, this malicious belief, is all that which really wants to react against the sinlessness of soul. So here we can see that against all these beliefs, really, we can only bring soul into action and see that instead of all these malicious beliefs, really, we should fill the life with good motives and acts, so that only a positive sense of soul can really control all these malicious animal magnetism beliefs. Text is that she says, sin, you hear right away it's the tone of soul, sin is subtle. Can you hear the subtlety? That's again animal magnetism. It's so undefined. It's so subtle that you never can really put your finger on it and define it and say, this is so and so, and this, that's its name. It's subtle. It does its work self-deceived. And she says, the most dangerous diseases come from where? From hidden, undefined and insidious beliefs. Can you see how important it is, what we have seen before in principle as truth, that we have really to tackle the hidden consciousness, the erroneous hidden consciousness, that subconsciousness which we do not know, those 90% of the iceberg that lies beneath the water and is not detected, not seen. It's danger not seen. And so the most dangerous beliefs really come from these hidden, insidious beliefs. And therefore we can see there is no other safety but in seeing that soul is always very definite, always very straightforward, always this defying quite clearly to the facts. There is nothing that can be misunderstood there, that it is direct, so to say. She takes here a case of a consumptive patient, and she says, tell them that blood can neither give nor take away life. There is more life in one good motive and act. You see, she comes back and says, fill the consciousness of your patient with good works, instead that you let him go along with these dangerous hidden beliefs and make him act consciously along the sinlessness of his life, the sinlessness of his deeds and acts. And that is the safety for him. Doesn't let in anything that is contrary to this definite good that he acts. Yes, that's soul. We come to principle. Again, the question is about the divine method. What is the divine method in principle? She says, arguing the true facts in regard to harmonious being. Can you recognize principle? Arguing the true facts, that's knowing the truth about what? About harmonious being, principle. Principle is always harmonious. And not by admitting that disease must have its course. That's a false way of life if we let disease have its course. We have a true way of life, the fullness of life. She reasons it this way. She says, because the so-called body is a mental concept and governed by mortal mind, it manifests only what so-called mortal mind expresses. Here you have really the life sense of the fatherhood sense, that the body only experiences what we entertain in consciousness, that the body is the expression of our consciousness. So, if mortal mind governs the body, then the body expresses discord. What is the remedy, she says? Destroy the patient's false belief. That's because discord is a false belief. How? Now we get the how, the method. The method of principle is by silently and audibly argue the true facts in regard to harmonious being. So it is the acknowledgement, establishment of the facts of harmonious being. So the practitioner only sees within his own mind always the true facts of being, and therefore projects on the situation, that's his fatherhood sense, his life sense, projects on the situation always the harmonious facts of being. Therefore, she says, in mind science, you cannot destroy a disease after admitting that it must have its course. See, there is only one way of life. But if you admit the false way of life, namely that disease must have its course, you can no more heal it. You have accepted the basis of the counterfeit of life, namely that disease has its course. She says, admitting the power of disease does what? It paralyzes, can you hear life, the counterfeit of life? It paralyzes scientific demonstration. What is scientific demonstration principle? Can you hear? She constantly blends principle and life and says there is only one life, the way of life. You can go only one way, and that is to establish in consciousness the facts about harmonious being. The moment you have admitted another course, another way, that disease must have its course, you have lost your case. Then you can treat that with all kinds of metaphysical truths. You can treat it as long as you like. It will have its course because you have admitted that at the first place. The point is, and that will paralyze your demonstration. We don't like to be paralyzed in our demonstration because paralysis is a counterfeit of life. We want to have the fullness of life, the living sense of life. And the living sense of life is that we can see from everlasting to everlasting, there is only one course that life takes, and that course of admitting the harmonious facts of being. Yes. Well, this is life as principle. So we stop here and go on tomorrow.